Welcome to the audio digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Michael Roy with highlights of the research appearing in the January 2008 issue. This month, we'll begin with our treatment and psychiatry feature, which discusses perimenopausal depression. We'll also examine disruption of existing mental health treatments and failure to initiate new treatment after Hurricane Katrina. We'll discuss frequency of provider contact after the FDA's advisory on pediatric suicidality risk with SSRI treatment. We'll highlight three articles in this issue that report relationships between environmental factors and the development of schizophrenia. The first article features a national cohort study that was conducted to examine childhood CNS infections and the risk of subsequent psychotic illness. The second article examined selected infectious agents and risk of schizophrenia among U.S. military personnel. The third article, a study of social environment, reports on the ethnic density of neighborhoods and incidence of psychotic disorders among immigrants. We'll conclude with an article discussing familial risk analyses of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and substance use disorders. Let's begin with this month's treatment and psychiatry feature, which reviews a common issue in clinical practice. This month, Barbara Perry discusses perimenopausal depression. Dr. Perry first summarizes the research that has shown a relationship between higher risk of major depressive episodes and the hormonal changes of the perimenopausal years. One study conducted a longitudinal evaluation with a structured interview used to determine depressive status. Plasma levels of follicle-stimulating hormone were measured at least twice a year for an average of 5 years. For the 24 months surrounding the women's final menses, the risk of depression onset was 14 times higher than for the preceding 3 decades. The timing of the depressions occurred in the context of recently elevated FSH levels. This suggests that an endocrine mechanism related to perimenopause was involved in the pathophysiology of the depression. Results of other systematic studies are consistent with these findings. An 8-year study followed 231 women who were about to enter menopause. These women did not have a depressive history. The menopausal transition was linked to more than double the risk of being diagnosed with a depressive disorder. It was associated with increases in FSH and luteinizing hormone, and it was associated with greater variability of estradiol and FSH. Studies of psychiatric histories in women with menopausal depression support a depressive diathesis at menopause. Over half of women with menopausal depression have a history of a previous depressive disorder. In a 5-year study of more than 2,500 women ages 45 to 55, prior depression was the variable most predictive of subsequent depression. Psychiatric symptoms at menopause are also related to previous depressions associated with the reproductive cycle, such as premenstrual syndrome or depression during pregnancy or the postpartum period. In women with bipolar illness, depressive episodes are likely to recur at menopause. Dr. Perry then goes on to discuss several studies that have examined the effects of hormone replacement on mood in menopausal depressed patients. The results vary depending on the specific diagnosis, type of menopausal symptoms, duration of treatment, and the dose and preparation of estrogen and progesterone replacement. In one 8-week pilot study of women with peri- or postmenopausal major depression, oral or transdermal 17-beta estradiol enhanced the antidepressant effects of fluoxetine. On the other hand, in a follow-up randomized clinical trial, the combination of antidepressant plus estrogen was not superior to the antidepressant alone. This finding is supported by results from other studies. However, in patients with refractory depression, estrogen may enhance the efficacy of antidepressant medication. In some small studies, investigators have examined the effect of conjugated estrogens or placebo for a month in premenopausal and postmenopausal women with refractory depression. Although there was no overall improvement in depression scores with estrogen or placebo, one patient showed striking improvement after 1 week of estrogen treatment and was no longer depressed after 2 weeks, a remission that lasted 3 months. Thus, occasionally patients do appear to have therapeutic responses to estrogen. In the studies that used progesterone in addition to estrogen, the progesterone tended to decrease the beneficial effects of estrogen. In some patients, it exacerbated the depressive symptoms, especially in those who had previous episodes of depression or who developed negative affect from contraceptives containing progestin. Dr. Perry concludes that hormonal therapies should be considered in light of other risk factors. although the Women's Health Initiative initially reported an increased incidence of breast cancer or cardiovascular disease over 5 years, the majority of the women in that study were 60 to 79 years old and had higher body mass indices. More recent evidence suggests that using hormone replacement within 10 years of menopause onset is associated with a reduced risk of cardiovascular disease. According to the North American Menopause Society, it is appropriate to use hormonal therapies to treat menopausal symptoms in the absence of related risk factors, such as cardiovascular disease and breast cancer, and to repeatedly present the option of stopping or reducing the dose. Now we'll turn to a survey of Hurricane Katrina survivors, where Philip Wang, Ronald Kessler and colleagues report on disruption of existing mental health treatments and failure to initiate new treatment after Hurricane Katrina. Data for the study came from pre-hurricane residents of Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana who were directly affected by Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Residents were recruited either by randomized telephone calls or from families applying to the American Red Cross for assistance. Pre-hurricane residents of the New Orleans metropolitan area were oversampled. Approximately 1,000 respondents completed a telephone survey in early 2006 that included a six-question scale, the K-6 scale, to screen for possible post-hurricane anxiety and mood disorders. The K-6 scale is a dimensional assessment of nonspecific psychological distress. Scores from 8 to 24 were classified as probable cases of psychological distress. All respondents who received professional counseling for these problems after the hurricane were asked about the number of sessions received, the duration of these sessions, and the types of professionals seen. Information was also obtained from respondents who screened positive for psychological distress, but did not receive either counseling or medication. They were asked about their reasons for not obtaining treatment, including their perception of the need for treatment, enabling factors such as health insurance, and predisposing factors such as stigma or perceived effectiveness. Overall, 19% of the respondents without pre-existing mental disorders screened positive for psychological problems at the time of the survey. Respondents in the New Orleans area were especially affected. Their prevalence was 36%. Fewer than one-fifth of those with post-hurricane disorders received any treatment. Most of those who did seek treatment received services from general medical doctors and were treated with medication but not psychotherapy. Among those who developed mental disorders after the hurricane but did not get treatment, the most common reason was a lack of perceived need, especially the belief that the symptoms would get better with time on their own. This reason was reported by 69% of the respondents in the New Orleans area and 89% of respondents in other areas. More of the New Orleans residents cited financial barriers and other enabling factors. The odds of receiving treatment for post-hurricane disorders were significantly lower for non-white respondents and those without health insurance. An estimated 21% of the respondents reported having a mental disorder in the 12 months before the hurricane. More than one-fifth of these individuals reported either reducing or terminating treatment because of the hurricane. Enabling factors were by far the most commonly reported reasons. Financial barriers were cited frequently. The unavailability of services was also reported by many respondents in New Orleans. Transportation problems were noted by many of those in other areas. Overall, the odds of continuing treatment were significantly lower for younger respondents and those with lower family incomes. Next, we'll highlight a report by Elaine Morado and colleagues that examined the clinical practice effects of an FDA advisory. In 2003, the Food and Drug Administration issued an advisory that included a recommendation for close supervision following new prescriptions of antidepressants. The authors examined whether contacts between healthcare providers and patients taking antidepressants changed after the advisory was issued. The analysis included more than 200,000 records from a national claims database of managed care plans during the period 1998 to 2005. The percentage of patients with adequate contact frequency before the FDA warning was compared with the percentage of patients with adequate contact frequency after the advisory. Two standards for contact frequency were used. One was from the NCQA Health Plan Employer Data and Information Set, or HEDIS. The NCQA defined optimal practitioner contact as three contacts in the 3 months following the diagnosis of major depressive disorder. The FDA recommendation was more stringent, calling for 7 visits in 3 months. Pediatric and adult patients were examined separately. The pediatric cohort consisted of patients 5 to 18 years old, and it included more than 27,000 patients with new episodes of major depression who were treated with antidepressants. The adult cohort comprised nearly 200,000 patients. Before the advisory, fewer than 5% of all patients had the number of contacts recommended by the FDA, and this rate did not change after the advisory. The proportion of patients who met the NCQA criterion before the advisory was 60% for children and 40% for adults. These rates also did not change after the advisory. Compliance with the more lenient standard after the advisory was greatest for patients seen by psychiatrists. The proportion of patients whose care met the criterion was 80% for pediatric patients seen by psychiatrists, compared with 50 to 60% for those seen by pediatricians or primary care physicians. The rates for adults were 65% for those seen by psychiatrists, and only 37% for those treated by primary care physicians. In an editorial that discusses this study, Graham Emsley reminds us that in the 1970s and 1980s, the focus of research was on whether depressive disorders even occurred in the pediatric population, and if they did, whether they were the same as depressive disorders in adults. Research on antidepressant treatment for pediatric depression increased over the next 20 years, but only about 250 children were involved in randomized controlled trials. The lack of results demonstrating efficacy of tricyclic antidepressants in pediatric populations suggested that extrapolating from adult data was problematic in this population, so additional studies specific to children and adolescents were needed. In 1997, the FDA Modernization Act made it mandatory that all new compounds with potential use in the pediatric population be studied in children and adolescents. In 2002, this legislation was followed by the Best Pharmaceuticals for Children Act, which established a process for studying medications in pediatric populations. In the past 10 years, the number of pediatric subjects enrolled in randomized controlled trials has increased by more than 200%. These studies have provided substantial information on the use of antidepressants in the pediatric population. Dr. Emsley states that the article by Morato and colleagues raises several important questions with regard to the controversy about treating depression in youths, which is focused on determining which treatments are effective and safe. However, a major concern, usually missed in this controversy, is that fewer than 50% of children and adolescents with depression ever receive treatment at all. Also, among youths who do receive evidence-based treatment, they rarely receive it as recommended. Visit frequency obviously is not equivalent to optimal treatment, but it is an important component. Even before the FDA advisory, published treatment guidelines recommended follow-up visits every 1 to 2 weeks after initiation of medication. These visits were to monitor for side effects, which generally occur early in treatment. Clearly, if patients, either pediatric or adult, do not receive adequate follow-up care, the result is often poor compliance and poor outcome. Over 50% of adults with depression who are given a 30-day prescription by a primary care physician do not refill the prescription. Treatment guidelines have been developed by APA and the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. However, research to examine guideline implementation has been limited, despite evidence that adhering to guidelines improves outcome. In addition, there is a great need for psychiatrists to collaborate with primary care physicians to improve the treatment of depression in primary care. The FDA advisory emphasized close monitoring of pediatric patients after initiation of antidepressant treatment. However, this attempt at changing provider behavior appears to have resulted in an overall decrease in antidepressant prescriptions for children and adolescents, with no apparent change in monitoring. Furthermore, the decrease in prescriptions very likely has had an adverse impact on youths who genuinely need antidepressant treatment, as suggested by the subsequent rise in suicides in this age group. Now let's turn to the three articles that examine the relationship between environmental factors and schizophrenia. The first is by Christina Dahlman and colleagues, who report on infections in the CNS during childhood and the risk of subsequent psychotic illness. This Swedish cohort study involved more than 1 million subjects. The authors identified all children in Sweden born between 1973 and 1985 who were hospitalized for infections of the central nervous system before their 12th birthday. This information was obtained by using the Swedish National Inpatient Register, which contains data on all inpatient episodes since 1973. This source was also used to extract data on subsequent non-affective psychotic illness in the cohort through the end of 2002. numerous viral and bacterial infections were included in the search. Of approximately 1 million children with infections, more than 2,000 were later diagnosed with a non-affective psychosis. Among these, 23 individuals have been diagnosed with a CNS infection before the age of 12. Dahlman et al. Report a slightly increased risk of developing a non-affective psychosis later in life if a child had been exposed to a viral CNS infection. This risk was higher in females. There was no evidence of an increased risk associated with bacterial infections. When the analyses were restricted to schizophrenia specifically, the results were similar. Examination of specific infectious agents indicated that the risk for non-affective psychosis was related to CNS infections by the mumps virus or cytomegalovirus. CNS infections caused by enteroviruses were not associated with the development of non-affective psychotic illness. The finding that an elevated risk of psychosis is associated with mumps virus and cytomegalovirus indicates that the risk relates to infectious agents with a propensity to invade the brain parenchyma rather than to CNS infections in general. The authors note, however, that the numbers of affected subjects were small, and the results concerning specific infectious agents should be interpreted with caution. The second article in this group of studies examining environmental influences on the development of schizophrenia is by David Niebuhr and colleagues. They report on selected infectious agents and risk of schizophrenia among U.S. military personnel. Much of the recent research on links between schizophrenia and infectious agents has focused on infections with, or antibodies to, neurotropic agents. These include viruses in the herpes simplex family and Toxoplasma gondii. An association between toxoplasma and schizophrenia was confirmed by a recently published meta-analysis. However, most studies have assessed antibody levels among acutely ill or first-onset patients. The U.S. military's practice of routinely collecting serum samples afforded a unique opportunity to conduct a large, population-based serological analysis of specimens obtained before the diagnosis of disease. Information was obtained from physical disability databases of the Army, Navy, and Air Force. The authors identified all military members who were medically discharged between 1992 and 2001 for disability associated with a diagnosis of schizophrenia. A total of 180 with available serum samples were included. Healthy comparison subjects were selected from the military service members with no diagnosis of a mental health disorder, and they were matched in a 3-to-1 ratio with the schizophrenia patients. Serum samples are obtained when service members enter the military and approximately every 2 years after that. Most of the patients with schizophrenia had 2 or 3 specimens available. These were analyzed to measure immunoglobulin G antibody levels to Toxoplasma gondii, 6 herpes viruses, and influenza A and B viruses. Immunoglobulin M antibody levels to Toxoplasma gondii were also measured. Niebuhr and colleagues report the immunoglobulin G antibody was significantly related to schizophrenia. However, the association was linked to the time at which the serum specimens were collected. The frequency of Toxoplasma gondii antibodies was significant for specimens collected within the 6 months before the diagnosis of schizophrenia and for the 1 year after the diagnosis, but not for periods preceding the schizophrenia by more than 6 months. Our third article, on environmental factors in schizophrenia, is presented by Wim Vailing, Ezra Susser, and colleagues. It discusses ethnic density of neighborhoods and incidence of psychotic disorders among immigrants. A striking finding from epidemiological studies is the high rate of schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders among several ethnic minority groups, mainly in Western Europe. Increasingly, investigators suspect that the social experiences of immigrant groups after migration contribute to their elevated risk of psychotic disorders. This study focused on immigrants in The Hague and examined how many people from the same country live in each section of the city. This ethnic density was examined prospectively in relation to psychotic disorders over 7 years. The 3 largest groups of first and second generation non-Western immigrants were included: Moroccans, Surinamese, and Turks. The Hague consists of 44 neighborhoods, classified according to postal codes. For each neighborhood, the ethnic density was computed for each immigrant group as the proportion of residents belonging to that group. In 2 neighborhoods, the proportion of all non-Western immigrants was 83%. Since the proportions of non-Western immigrants in other neighborhoods were considerably smaller, These two neighborhoods were classified as having high ethnic densities, and the other neighborhoods were classified as having low densities. The authors also determined the number of people age 15 to 54 who made a first contact with a physician for a possible psychotic disorder. Nearly 500 people were identified who could be linked to specific neighborhoods. The incidence rate ratio was used to express the rate of new onset psychotic disorders in the immigrant groups in relation to the native Dutch population. The incidence rate ratio was 1.25 for immigrants in neighborhoods with high densities of their own ethnic groups, but it was 2.36 in low-density neighborhoods. The ratios were similar in first-generation and second-generation immigrants. Similar patterns were also evident within the individual immigrant groups. However, the difference between low- and high-density neighborhoods was the greatest for the Moroccans. In neighborhoods with low densities of Moroccans, the incidence of psychotic disorders among Moroccan immigrants was more than four times as high as the rate for native Dutch residents. Our final article is by Joseph Biederman and colleagues, who examined familial risk analyses of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and substance use disorders. Boys with ADHD and comparison boys were identified between the ages of 6 and 17 and were followed up longitudinally. At the 10-year follow-up, they were assessed for lifetime substance use disorders, which were categorized as involving either alcohol or a drug. More than 100 probands with ADHD and more than 100 comparison probands were interviewed at 10 years. Siblings were also assessed at 10 years, and parents were assessed at baseline. The authors found that ADHD in the proband was consistently associated with a significantly increased risk for ADHD in relatives. ADHD in the proband also predicted substance use disorder in general and drug dependence specifically in the relatives. On the other hand, alcohol dependence in relatives was predicted only by ADHD probands with comorbid alcohol dependence. Both alcohol dependence and drug dependence bred true in families, without evidence of a common risk between these disorders. Drug dependence was also associated with ADHD, however, since drug dependence in the comparison probands increased the risk for ADHD in relatives. Although probands with and without ADHD did not differ on the absolute rate of substance use disorder overall, those with ADHD had an earlier onset, a longer duration, and higher rates of severely impairing substance use disorder, as well as higher rates of alcohol and drug dependence specifically. Moreover, probands with ADHD had more first-degree relatives with alcohol or drug dependence than did comparison probands. In his editorial that discusses these findings, Leonard Adler points to the National Comorbidity Survey, which found that adult ADHD commonly co-occurs with a variety of mental health disorders, including dysthymia, major depression, anxiety disorders, bipolar disorder, and psychoactive substance use disorders. Since ADHD is known to have a high rate of familial transmission, with heritability estimates of about 75%, this high rate emphasizes the need for additional longitudinal familial studies of ADHD and comorbid disorders, such as that reported by Biederman and colleagues. The authors found that ADHD in the boys was significantly predictive of ADHD in their relatives, supporting prior work on the familial nature of the disorder. Boys who had ADHD, with or without substance use disorders, had significantly higher rates of substance use disorders in their relatives compared to boys without either ADHD or psychoactive substance use disorders. However, there is no evidence that ADHD and substance use disorders were always transmitted together as a single entity. The groups with substance use disorders were subdivided into those with alcohol dependence and those with drug dependence. Drug dependence in the boys significantly increased the risk for drug dependence in the relatives, regardless of the presence of ADHD. On the other hand, alcohol dependence in the relatives was predicted by the combination of ADHD and alcohol dependence in the boys. ADHD itself predicted drug dependence in the boys and in relatives. There was separate transmission of alcohol and drug dependence in families. The authors concluded that the familial risk analyses suggested differing patterns of transmission. The association of ADHD and drug dependence was compatible with a common risk for these disorders by means of a variable expressivity, sometimes ADHD, and sometimes substance use disorders. However, ADHD and alcohol dependence seem to have independent transmission. The finding of differing transmission patterns should be kept in mind in future familial studies of these disorders. Since the primary substance of dependence in the study was marijuana, it would be important to attempt to replicate the findings regarding transmission of ADHD and drug dependence in cohorts of patients who are dependent on other substances. Primary care physicians frequently attempt to screen for a variety of mental health disorders. When physicians are screening for ADHD and substance use disorders, it would be important to keep in mind that the familial transmission of ADHD and drug dependence may differ from the transmission of ADHD and alcohol abuse. Furthermore, the finding highlights the need to identify ADHD in patients or relatives of patients with substance use disorders. This concludes the audio highlights of the January issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. We invite you to refer to the online issue at ajp.psychiatryonline.org for the full text of these and other articles. We also welcome comments regarding this audio program. They can be emailed to Senior Editor Jane Weaver, and her email address is jweaver@psych.org. Thank you.